So please welcome Vita Jones Cox and Bill Cook.
Bill said, "Vina, you write the introduction. I don't have time." He makes mistakes like that quite often. Alright, is everybody doing good today?
Yeah.
Good. Seen some good presenters?
Yeah.
Taking some good notes? Gotten some good things you're going to go do when you get home? Alright, we have the only presentation that comes with a user warning. The warning is this. Between Bill and I, we have over 50 years experience doing the thing that we're going to talk about today. And that creates a little bit of a problem. That means we have a lot of ideas and opinions about how to do subject twos and do them correctly. Unfortunately, this conference is run by a raving lunatic redhead who makes everybody get off stage at 90 minutes. And can't break that just because she's the one on stage.
So here for the raving lunatic.
We only have 90 minutes to talk about what we want to talk about, and I will add to that, he and I have never given this presentation before. So we spent 2 days fighting about, no, this must be included, no, we don't have time for it, and we'll see how it goes. But my feel is that we're not going to get to cover everything that we would like to cover, because subject two is a much deeper topic than what you have heard about on YouTube. In fact, if you could just erase everything you heard on YouTube out of your brain right now, that would be a really good start to understanding subject twos. So, I'm going to ask you to buckle up, because we're going to talk fast. Well, I'm going to talk fast. Bill's going to talk like he's from Georgia. I'm going to talk fast. Put on your thinking cap. You're not sitting there passively listening, okay? I want you to think about what's being said and what does it mean and how does it apply to deals I've already seen and how does it apply to deals that I'm supposed to go see next week. We want you to participate. There's going to be some, audience question type thing, and we need to move that along. I can't ask a question. Have you guys go, all right, talk and talk fast. Take lots of notes and understand that this is probably not the end of your creative deal structuring education, this 90 minutes that we're going to spend together. One of the things that we decided that we were going to do to make up for the fact that there's some really key things in here that take 20 to 30 minutes to explain all by themselves, and we just do not have it. We just do not have the time. Is we are going to do mini workshops in the bookstore tomorrow.
Yay!
Y'all have found the bookstore, right?
Yes.
Around the corner, there's free coffee there. Smell the free coffee. And there's things that you're going to want to know more about that we will during the breaks stand there and really explain, right? So those are going to be at 8 a.m., 10 a.m., and 3 o'clock. That's in between other sessions, so you don't have to worry about missing something that you want to see. So you don't have to register. Just show up. We'll be there. We'll talk to nobody if nobody's there. We'll talk to everybody if everybody's there. Okay, so let's start with just the super basics here. Who doesn't really know what subject two is? Okay, who sort of knows what it is, but not enough that you'd be brave enough to go try and do it? Okay, that's almost everybody in the room. Who's done a subject two? Oh, good, good. So y'all will be answering the questions when they come up, right?
Yeah.
I remember everyone who just had their hand up. I'm going to come pick on you if nobody's answering the questions. Okay, so let's just do a quick definition for the folks who aren't super sure what it's about. Subject two is, it's like shorthand, right? It's like real estate investor jargon. If we're going to say the whole sentence, we would say, I bought a property subject to, and then something, but normally when you say, oh, I got a, we just like to not waste syllables in the real estate investing world. What you'll really hear somebody say is, I did a sub two, right? They shorten it to even beyond the three syllables of subject two. Usually when someone says, I bought a property subject two, or I bought a sub two, what they mean is, I bought it subject to the seller's existing first mortgage. So what does that mean? It means the mortgage, which is the security instrument for the bank's loan, Right? The mortgage is the thing that says, if you don't make your payments, we get to use this property to get ourselves paid back. But the mortgage is against the property, right? And nothing happens to the mortgage when you buy sub 2. It just stays right where it is. It's still at the courthouse. It's still in effect. The note, which is the piece that says I will pay you back, and here's the terms, right? The note is between the bank and the borrower, stays in the name of the borrower, who we're going to call the seller, because they're selling the property subject to their existing loan. But the deed at the closing transfers from the seller to you. So you got all the pieces there. There's a deed. You get it. There's a mortgage. It stays right where it is. There's a note. And the borrower, the seller, is still obligated to the bank to pay it at the end of a subject to. You, because you said so, because you made a promise and you're going to keep it, are responsible for making the payments to the bank after the closing, but that promise is between you and the seller. It's not between you and the bank. The bank doesn't know what's happening here, and we're going to show you how they don't find that out. Okay? The bank doesn't know about you. The seller is still legally obligated to make the payments. You are obligated to the seller to make them. If you don't make them, the bank is not coming after you because they don't know about you. They know about the guy who made the loan application 10 years ago and who's at the bottom, whose name is signed at the bottom of their mortgage. So the purpose of doing all of this is, when you know how, and you know how to do it right, which is the topic today, you can create win-win deals with sellers that leave them better off than they were before. And they also leave you better off than you were before. You wouldn't do them, right? We want both wins. We don't just want to win for the seller. We also want to win for ourselves. These deals, if you're doing them right, are really, really good for creating long-term cash flow and equity in houses. Now, when you do these deals, do you have to qualify for a mortgage?
No.
No, somebody already qualified, but it wasn't you. It was the seller. When you do these deals, do you have to put 20% down?
No.
Wait, what are you talking about? It's a bank loan. You have to put 20% down on a bank loan, don't you? Now, somebody else already made the down payment, right? Years before you came into the picture. The interest rates that you can take over today. My record so far is 3.125%. I have never been able to get a 3.125% loan as an investor. But homeowners have been able to get them, right? I'm looking for my first sub 3% subject to, like one of those 2.85% loans that people get right now in 2-3 years. If those folks get in trouble, they're going to be looking to sell that property, and they might do it subject to that 2.85% loan. Also, huge advantage, a lot of the investor financing that we're able to get has balloons in it, right? Are balloons a problem? Okay, if you're not saying yes, just pretend like you know that they are, okay? Because they always seem like such a great idea when you're certain out they're 5 years away. It's just in 4 years and 6 months when you realize interest rates have doubled and there's no money available, and and even if you get a new loan at the current interest rate, your property's not going to cash flow, then you decide it's like a really bad idea. Use our experience with that. Don't have to go experience it for yourself, okay? So knowing how to do them means you can solve the problems of more sellers that you talk to. Let that sink in for a minute. Doing the same exact marketing, getting the same exact calls from the same exact sellers, but I can do twice as many deals because I have a second solution. I don't just have to offer a lowball cash offer. I can also offer, hey, I can give you more money. Let me take over your loan. Would that solve more problems than lowball cash offers?
Yeah.
Same marketing, twice the effect. No more marketing money, twice the effect. It also means you can own more rentals or lease options or whatever it is you like to do with them once you have them than you can probably buy conventionally. I mean, most of us, even if we have a bunch of money when we get started in the business, which most of us don't, we can't put down too many 20% down payments till we run out of money, right? So if you don't have to put 20% down payment down, you could own endless houses, right? You can own as many as you can effectively manage. It also creates more cash flow on your properties when the interest rates are lower. Those are directly tied together. I could show you a spreadsheet, but the reality is you're going to make more money on a $200,000 house that has a 3% loan on it than one that has a 6% loan on it. Okay? So, you get to conserve your cash, which is good because sometimes these houses need repairs. They're not all in perfect shape. If you have some money, maybe you put it into the fix-up of the property instead of the down payment. It lets you do more deals, more profitable deals, and deals that make no sense whatsoever if you don't know how to do subject two. So, that's the, what is subject two? Who's still confused? That's interesting, because Bill thought he was going to have to do a visual. Bill wants to do, Bill has worked out a whole visual thing. Oh, now they're fessing up. Okay, so here's the thing. His little visual thing takes about 10 minutes because he's got like, you know, moving stuff around, and here this goes here, and this goes here, and this goes here. So tomorrow at the bookstore at 10:30, he will walk you through the visual and answer any other questions that you have.
10 o'clock,
sorry. Okay, so there are deals that you have seen, every single one of you has seen, that you couldn't make sense of. The seller wanted full price. The seller needed the property's too expensive for its cash flow if you went and got conventional loans, all that stuff, right? You've seen these deals, and you've gone, sorry, Mr. Seller, next, right? The thing is, when you understand subject two, sometimes you can make these deals make sense. You want to see an example?
Yeah.
This is Pitter Drive. I found this property in 2001 door knocking. There's a real... I owe you all an apology. Especially to the women in the room. Several months ago, I looked at Vina and I said, "You're like Supergirl." And Vina got very upset with me. Vina, will you tell people why you got upset because I called you Supergirl as you go fluid and you're not...
Bill, your memory of things I say to you is so much better than my memory of things that I say
to you. Why don't you like to be compared to Supergirl? She said the Supergirl is not Superman, it's a girl. She's not a girl, she's a woman. And she says she's also a goddess. We all know that Venus is a real estate goddess. So I felt very bad about that. And I felt the need to correct this awful, awful mistake that I made. And so I had custom made, using pictures of Vina, her own bobblehead doll with your earrings. Hand-painted, hand-carved, you're Wonder Woman. I'm so sorry.
I do remember that now because I said Supergirl's just a Superman knockoff that was to buy girls' comic books. Wonder Woman is the shit. Wonder Woman, there's no male equivalent of Wonder Woman. So, yeah.
So, I get to Vina, give me a hand. But, you know... Wonder Woman to be there all by herself, and we don't want to have Wonder Woman there all by herself.
Is this why you made me cut slides out of our presentation?
Yes. Because we all know, truly, because I had another custom bobblehead made, and we know that Superman is faster than a speeding bullet, so I had one made of me. Well, Superman, custom made. So this could go right next to your little Wonder Woman, and you notice that Superman's actually bigger. This is not real life to scale.
Uh-huh.
Do the pictures later. But anyway, there you go. There's your Superman.
Well, okay. We'll put it over here, and then Bill can keep talking.
Yes.
How's that?
Okay. So anyway, I have been so excited. Could not wait to do that. I'm so happy. So anyway, I found this house. There was a house that was for sale, had a realtor sign in the yard. And I stopped and knocked the door, which is what you should do. Stop, get out of your car, because God wants you a door knock. Matthew 7:7. Anyone know what Matthew 7:7 says? Knock, and the door shall be opened. It's biblical. So anyway, when I knocked on this door, the seller's situation was they had moved in this house a year before. And they had found the house of their dreams in their old neighborhood where they grew up. This couple grew from about 10-12 miles away, and they wanted to go back there. And they wanted this house. They had it under contract. It was contingent. They had been approved for the loan. So everything's ready to go. So they didn't need to get a new loan to buy this house, but they refused to buy the house. They were going to give up and lose the house of their dreams because their old house wasn't selling, and he was most scared of two payments. He said, though I can qualify for the note, I'm terrified of what can happen if I'm now forced to make two house notes. And that's what really, really scared him. So these are the terms of a note that he had. And what it said, back one, please.
Oh, back up one? Sorry.
One. There you go. These are the terms.
Sorry, Bill. Are things not going the way you had hoped they would?
These are the terms of the note. So it was a 2000 note. We're talking about 2001. So had the and it was a zero down note. So had the note paid down in 1 year? No, the note hadn't paid down. And if you look at the payments were $560 a month. That's principal and interest. And when you add in the insurance and the taxes and expenses, it would rent for $750. So do you see what this is going to have no cash flow? So this was not the type of 72 deal that I normally like, because you've got no equity and you would have no cash flow, but I wouldn't lose any money either. And sometimes you've got to use long range glasses. Great house, great neighborhood, great area, not far from my house. You're all like the greatest couple. Anyway, so anyway, this was going to be a deal that is marginal at best. So would you do this deal? Would you do this as a 72 deal? Why? You shook your head up and down. The mortgage hadn't started yet, so it was a 30-year mortgage, so we got a long way to go. This is how I define a 72 deal, and this is how I describe it. When I'm talking to the homeowner, this is what I say. I'll buy your house, and I'll make your mortgage payments on your mortgage for you until your mortgage is paid off according to the terms of your note. So it's not an assumption. I'm not assuming the note is going to stay in her name. And we never, ever promise to pay off a seller's or a borrower's mortgage early. Dangerous. So today, this is where we stand. That house is free and clear. So you're talking 20 years later. It now has a value of $190,000, and it rents for $1,400 a month. Long-range glasses. Good deal?
Yeah.
It was a good deal. Dina?
Could you have made it any other way?
No.
Could you pay cash for that house and had it made any sense?
No.
Well, you could, but why buy that house? You can buy any house for full price. Right? So what made sense of this deal is something that's super important, and I want you to take some kind of note about this. All creative finance strategies have a dimension that we're not used to thinking in. We're used to looking at what's the ARV now? What are the repair costs now? What is the rent now? Being able to forecast what's it going to be in 5 years, what's it going to be in 10 years, what's it going to be in 20 years changes the picture. So if you see a great house in a neighborhood you really like and think in the future it's going to value is going to go up, rents are going to go up, you would love to own that house when you die. Neither one of us is going to blame you for paying full price and having zero cash flow until the rents go up, right? We need to be able to not just see what it is today, but see what it could be a few years in the future. That dimension of time is one real estate investors, and probably human beings in general, are not great at thinking about. But if you train yourself to think about it, then you do that deal instead of not doing that deal. So this workshop is about how to do subject to deals right. So let's look at what a subject to deal done wrong might appear to be. We're also calling this section "Everything You Heard on YouTube Will Get You in Trouble." All right. So here's how you do a subject to deal wrong, and I want you to count the wrongs. All right. We're gonna walk through a whole deal, and you're gonna count like how many things are going wrong here. You buy this $200,000 house for that is gonna rent for $1,500 a month. For $195,000, subject to a $195,000 adjustable rate loan, the current principal, interest, tax, and insurance payment is $1,299 a month. You convince the seller to do this by saying, "Don't worry, I'll pay your loan off in 3 years." You put it in a land trust to defeat the due on sale clause. You make it a no money down deal by closing it at McDonald's. Hey, we can all make deeds. Get a legal description, throw it in. How hard could it be?
Then there's a lot of moaning going around in the audience. A lot of moaning.
In order to keep the bank from knowing that the title is transferred, you keep the seller's insurance policy in place and you just start paying it. And for bonus wrongness, after you're done with all of this, you put it up on Facebook Marketplace and you flip it to another investor for a $5,000 cash payment.
That's the only thing they did right.
So how many things did you count? I asked you to count. How many things did you count that went wrong? Nine? Heard seven? Okay, there should be at least 10 things on your list. And I will give you a hint and say some of it is stuff you did and some of it is stuff that you did not do. Okay, so call out something that went wrong. Adjustable rate. Promising to pay off in 3 years. Leaving the seller's insurance. The principal interest tax and insurance payment is too high. The flipping it to somebody else. So you made this mess, and now it gets to be somebody else's mess. Great.
Not getting title insurance.
Not doing a professional closing. Didn't hear that.
He said eating at McDonald's. Pete would disagree.
Okay, let's untangle this, all right? Because if we can see how it was done wrong, we can see how to do it right. So you bought a $200,000 house subject to a $195,000 adjustable rate loan that rents for $1,500 and has a PITI payment. Problem number one was just straight up, this is the wrong deal. It's okay to walk away from no money down, no qualifying deals if they're stupid deals. How in the world is this deal supposed to make money? At $1,500 a month rent and almost $1,300 in payment, this deal has negative $99 in cash flow every month from day one. Because what you're not counting, if you think, what are you talking about? There's $200 in positive cash flow. It costs money to own a house. You've got vacancy, you've got maintenance, you've got capital expenditures. Remember, we're thinking long term here. I don't care if that roof is brand new. In 20 years, you're replacing it. And you better have some money saved up to do that, right? That's going to get worse. Because are the rates going to go anywhere other than up from here? So next year, there's every chance But the payment's going to be even higher, and next year after that, it'll be a good chance it'll be even higher than that. Also, do rents ever go down? No, that was somebody who didn't live through 2009. Rents go down when there's a recession. Can you afford for this rent to go down 10 bucks? No, you cannot. Also, we got no equity here. If you're thinking, wait a minute, you bought it for $195, it's worth $200, that's $5,000 in equity. Yeah, it is if you can find a way to sell it with no costs of sale whatsoever. Yeah, here's something you write down if you haven't heard it before. If you sell a house conventionally, it costs you about 10% of the sale price of the house to sell it. The agent takes about 6%. Then you got transfer taxes, deed prep. Sellers asking for you to pay some points so they can have a lower interest rate. All it costs roughly 10% to sell a house. A good subject to deal needs some stuff. Like if you're gonna take a subject to deal seriously and go down the path of negotiating it, it either needs to have a lot of equity or it needs to have a lot of cash flow. You don't necessarily have to have both. It's great when you can get both. There's a third thing, and we're going back to that time. Remember, as time passes, things change, and that is, it could hit a lot of mortgage pay down. If you're taking over a loan that only has 10 years left to completely pay off, that means, yeah, it might not have any cash flow, but it's got a lot of equity pay down. So you're not putting a lot of money in your pocket every month. But you're putting a lot of money on your balance sheet every month when you make the payment. If you've got a $1,000 payment and $700 of that is going to principal, that's moving over to the right side of your balance sheet, right? Or it could have so much equity and not so much cash flow and not so much quick pay down. It could have, some of two or three of those things. So let's look at an example of lots of cash flow, not so much equity.
So this was a house, again, found through door knocking. Actually, when I was in the neighborhood, there was no sign in the yard. The house was trashed. I thought it was vacant. And so I stopped and knocked on the door. Nobody answered. And so I had to find information on the house. So where do you go to find information on a house where no one's there? So I found a website. Y'all might want to write this down. It's a free website. You can find out as much about a house as you will ever want to know, the history of it, what's happened to it, everything you want to know about a house, and it's free. Website is www.talktothedamnneighbors.com. Okay, so go to that website. It's going to be really good for you. So I did talk to the neighbors, and I got the owner's address. I found out that her husband had died, and she had moved actually to Adairsville, which is my little hometown. And when I found this out, I went and knocked on her door. So I didn't just wait. I didn't write her a letter. I just left that house. I drove right to where she was, and I was able to talk to her. She invited in. We sat down. We talked. And so this was her mortgage situation. Again, she confirmed that her husband had passed away. And she had moved out of that house because it was a four-bedroom, two-bath home, and she had moved into a three-bedroom, one-bath that was easier for her to maintain and take care of. She had rented her house to her sons. How do you think that went?
Not well.
Not well at all. So they had absolutely trashed her house. And she was furious with them, and she had said things to them, but just nothing had actually happened. Now, one of the things I want you to know is the mortgage balance is 78. The property's fair market value is 80. Is there any equity here? No, but I want you to take a look at the note. So when you're talking to homeowners, you want to find out and see the note, and you want to get the terms. And when someone says, "With the mortgage," it got warm in here all of a sudden. Thank you, Drew. I need a cigarette. Anyway, in this case, the loan had come from her mother. The loan came from her mother. And it was a $330 note, $333 a month, but the house was going to rent for $800 a month. Do you see where the last house didn't have cash flow? Do you see where this one does? And so we looked at this and said, hey, this is good. So there's not equity, but there's a lot of cash flow here. So this to me was a lot safer deal than the last deal I showed you. and we can go to cash flow. Again, my phrase is simple. We will buy your house. We will make your mortgage payments on your mortgage for you until your mortgage is paid in full according to the terms of your note. I'm not assuming the loan. The loan does not go into my name. And during the bookstore tomorrow, we'll talk about that a number of times. And so I never promise to pay off a mortgage early. That's so dangerous. So here's where this house stands now. So it's, what, 18 years later or something like that? And the house is now free and clear. So we have paid her, we paid off her note. But who paid off the note? Who really paid this off? The renters did. And the big thing problem she had is she didn't want to evict her children. She just wanted them gone. And she didn't want the house anymore. She wanted it gone. So she sold the house to me because I would evict her sons nicely. And she didn't want to have bad Thanksgivings for the rest of her life where they said, Mom, remember that time you evicted us? And the rent on this house is $1,100 per month. Good cash flow? Good deal.
Okay. So how many of you would do that deal now? Okay. Because it's a pretty safe deal. Tenants are covering the payment every month. Who cares how much you owe? You're not selling it anyway, right? And then after 18 years, you look like a genius. Because you have a house that's doubled in value and you own it free and clear. Now, there's a flip side to that, which is not so much cash flow, but equity and mortgage pay down. And this is going to be more challenging to your guts. Ready? This house, which is on Holiday Hills here in Cincinnati, it's in Anderson Township. It was a $200,000 house that would rent for $1,500 a month. And it had a $160,000 mortgage. So there's some equity there, right? Like that. The problem is, it had a $1,200 a month principal, interest, taxes, and insurance payment. Because the seller had gotten a 15-year loan, which he had already paid on for 4 years. So those of you who have amortization schedules in your heads, that's not me. I have to get out a spreadsheet and figure out how much the amortization is every month at this point. But what that means is by year four of that $1,200 a month payment, first month you're paying off $289 worth of mortgage, and that gets bigger and bigger and bigger every month. I found this one by marketing, like I find all of my other deals. This was an expired listing. So I sent him a postcard saying, hey, if you still want to sell your house, call me. I may have some solutions that other people didn't have for you. He had already bought his next house, and now he was making two mortgage payments. Now, this guy made a lot of money. He and his wife both made a lot of money. So it wasn't that they couldn't afford it. But nobody likes making two mortgage payments. No matter how much money you're making, nobody likes putting out $1,200 a month on something that you're not using at all. So what did I do with this house once we closed it up? I lease optioned it. I lease optioned it at a payment of $1,500 a month, which meant it broke even. Like I didn't take a bunch of money out of my pocket. So there were some months when it might have been, $5, with some stuff I had to pay for the house. But when I sold it 8 years later, I only owed $23,000 on it. Why? How did that happen? Because by then it was 3 years from complete payoff. Right? And yes, I had to go through three lease option tenants to find one who stuck. Lease optioned it three different times before the one who finally bought it. And yes, I didn't make any money during that time except I made a few thousand off of option fees. But at the end, I got a check for over $100,000 because of the mortgage pay down. Guys, when you hear somebody say, well, my loan payment is this and my balance is this and it only has 11 more years, you should get excited. Because that 11 years is going to go by whether you buy that house or not, and you might as well have a paid off house at the end of it. So we need lots of cash flow or lots of equity or lots of mortgage pay down or some of all of the above. You got it? Okay. You need to teach yourself how to evaluate these properties. You need to begin with the end in mind and say, how much can I realistically rent it for or lease option it for or whatever you plan to do? What is the ARV? Yes. What is the repair? What are the repair costs? Those are all important in subject two. So if you don't know how to do that, I'm going to take like a real estate 101 class and they'll teach you how to do that sort of stuff. You need to walk away from deals that don't have enough cash flow or equity or mortgage pay down to make it make sense. One of my favorite things to say is not all no money down deals are good deals. Sometimes we get really excited about, oh my God, this person's actually going to let me take over their mortgage, and we lose sight of the fact that we don't want to. I have turned down more subject to deals than I have done. When I said, hey, would you consider taking over a mortgage payment? Seller says, yeah. That's how I say it, by the way. When I'm talking to a seller on the phone, I don't say, hey, would you consider doing this deal subject to the existing loan? I say, would you consider some kind of takeover payments deal? I understand that, right? You're going to take over my payments. And if they say yes, then I say, well, let's talk about the payments I'd be taking over. And if they're giving me information that tells me there's no equity, no cash flow, and also it's got 29 and a half years left on the mortgage, I just say, well, that's not going to work. We need to think about something else. Any deal that is risky for you is risky for your seller. Why? You are going to default. And when you do, there's no equity to protect the deal. If you can't handle the $99 a month in negative cash flow, oh, and then, by the way, furnace goes out, so this month you've got an extra $3,000 payment to make, you're not going to be able to make the payments, and you're not going to be able to sell the house to satisfy the mortgage and keep the seller out of foreclosure. Don't do deals that are risky for you because they're real deals that are risky for other people. Okay. Next thing that was wrong is you convince the seller to do the deal by promising to pay off the loan in 3 years. What is wrong here is that you have the wrong seller. Sometimes it's the wrong property, sometimes it's the wrong seller. If the deal isn't obviously right for the seller, it's not right for you either. You should not do any deal with any seller. I don't care if you think you're going to make $1 million off this deal in the next 20 years. You should not do any deal with any seller who really needs that mortgage paid off early. Because whether that's for psychological reasons, whether they're just not comfortable with it, or whether they say, well, in 3 years I'm going to be buying my dream house. It doesn't matter why. If they need it paid off, you don't do this deal. Now, some of you are thinking, no, sure, I will. I'll lease option it in a year. Somebody will buy it from me, and the mortgage will be paid off. That's what I thought about Holiday Hills. Took 8 years to actually sell that house. Do not do deals with sellers who have an FHA or VA loan and need to use their FHA or VA allowance to buy their next house. Why? You know, the rules with FHA and VA changed about 10 years ago. It used to be you could have 15 FHA loans. Now you can have one. Used to be as long as your VA allowance, you know, you had a VA allowance and you could buy as many houses as that VA allowance would let you have. Now you can have one. So if you take over and don't pay off the VA loan, can that seller go get another house with his VA allowance? Why not? You're making the payments. It doesn't matter. It's still on their credit, right? Do not deal. Do not do these deals with sellers who must have this mortgage paid off so that they can qualify for their next mortgage. In other words, where their loan-to-income ratio is such that if they don't get this one off, they can't get the next one. There is a solution for that kind of seller, but it's not subject to. No, that actually won't work either, because they need to get this loan paid off so that they can qualify for the next one, unless they rent the house. If they rent the house, the mortgage broker will look at the incoming rent and say, well, that's part of your income, and if it's bigger than your mortgage payment, you're good. Right? You got this extra income, yeah, you got this mortgage payment, but you still qualify for the next loan. So how can we use the idea of them renting the house to get control of the house? We lease option it, right? Could we lease option it where the option is to buy it subject to after they have closed their next house? We could do that, right? The option doesn't have to be, I have an option to buy it for cash. It could be, I have an option to buy it subject to your existing loan. So that might only be 2-3 months. Right, you sign the lease, they go get their new loan, they close it, now you exercise your option and buy it subject to their loan. Do not deal with sellers who don't seem to understand what they're signing. That will cause you so many problems up the road, you just can't picture. I had a seller who for 3 years in a row called up about January 3rd, and said, can you send me the 1099 interest form that the bank sent so that I can give it to my CPA? Because all the bank stuff was coming to my house, right? Because we changed the address so I could know, like, if the escrow went up or down or whatever. Every year she did this, and every year I said, you can't deduct the interest paid. Why not? Why can't she deduct it? She didn't pay it! Every year we have this conversation, and she'd get upset and say, but it's in my social security. I understand, but you can't deduct stuff you didn't pay for. That was a seller who didn't quite understand exactly what she was getting into, and she caused me to change my seller disclosure to specify this piece of it. I'll tell you more about that seller disclosure in a minute. Do not deal with people who have to be talked into subject to. It's either good for them or it's not. Now, does that mean you won't have to explain what it is?
Yeah.
Of course you have to explain what it is. Sellers don't know what subject to is. But if you have to spend a whole lot of time going, no, seriously, buddy, you love this. They'll love it until it's 2 years later and their life is back together and they've talked to their sister-in-law, the real estate agent, who said, I think you got defrauded. Like, if they aren't totally 100% bought in once you've explained it to them, don't do the deal. So who does that leave? I just X'd off a bunch of sellers. Who's left? The answer is sellers who don't intend to ever buy another house. You'd be amazed at how many people I talk to that are in that position. They're retiring. They're like, yeah, I'm just going to rent from now on. I don't ever want to mow another lawn in my entire life. Or they say, I just inherited my parents' farm where I grew up, and that's my dream house. I'm going to live there for the rest of my life. Sellers who are deceased are probably not going to need their credit going forward.
How do you market
to them? Your probate marketing will turn up a lot of heirs who have a house that has a mortgage on it that the heirs can't pay or don't want to pay. When you say, well, what if I paid it? They're like, sure. They're not even worried about the heir. They're like, yeah, they don't even have that thought about, what if you don't make the payments? So what, dad's going to go into foreclosure? Sellers who are selling a house subject to an investment loan. So these are, you know how Fannie Mae has the homeowner side and the investor side, and the down payments are different, and the rates are different, and all that sort of stuff. You can get a Fannie Mae investor loan. Y'all know this, right? And it's different than a Fannie Mae homeowner loan. Those don't count against your availability to go get another home to live in. So if the investor bought the property as an investment property, it's probably not going to cause problems for him up the road if you take it over. Sellers who have already qualified for and closed on their next house are not going to have that debt-to-income ratio problem because it's already fixed. Do not risk leaving a seller worse off for having done business with you. You want him to be better off for having done business with you, and that still leaves you with plenty of sellers. Okay, what else do we do wrong? Well, we put it in a land trust to defeat the due on sale clause. Every time I read that sentence in, you know, some e-book I bought or something, oh, you use the land trust to defeat the due on sale clause, I throw up in my mouth a little. And in addition, we try to save some money by closing it outside of a typical title company or attorney type situation. This is the wrong paperwork and the wrong closing process. It's going to cause all sorts of issues up the road. Fact check! How many of you have heard that land trust defeat to avoid the due on sale clause? It's okay if you've heard it, it's just not okay if you believe it. Okay, so we've heard that. They do not, in fact, defeat the due on sale clause. That is a total, it's a misreading of what the Garn St. Germain Act says, and I'm going to come back to this in a little bit. I am not saying don't close the deals in a land trust. I'm saying don't do it because you believe that now the bank can't call the loan due because it's in a land trust. That's the part that's not true. The reason you're going to close in a land trust is because you're going to close in a special kind of land trust called a seller protection land trust. The reason it's a special kind of land trust is it has some special language in it, and that special language is if the buyer, who's that? You. If the buyer fails to make a payment and the payment gets 30 days delinquent, the trustee is ordered, in the language of the land trust, to sign the deed back to the seller. Going to give that a minute to sink in. What is the seller's number one objection to you taking over their mortgage going to be? What if you don't pay? And that is a really legitimate concern, because if you don't pay, they really don't have any way of getting the house back other than suing you, and they don't have any way of protecting their credit except making payments on a house they no longer own. So if you set it up so that... that's just not going to happen. If the payment gets 30 days late, the trustee has to deed the property back to the seller. Doesn't that overcome their number one objection? Can't you say to a seller who says, well, what if you don't make my payments? Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I've had a lot of sellers over the years who have asked me that. Now, the way my attorney and I have found to overcome it is we're going to set it up at the closing so that if I miss a payment, you get the house back within 15 days with no legal costs. No, like you just ask for the deed back and you get it. Would that make you feel better? What do they say? That sounds great. Tell me more. And at that point, you have to say, well, I'll tell you what, when I come out and see you, I'll bring you the paperwork. You can have your attorney look at it. They can tell. Don't try and explain this kind of in-depth legal thing to a civilian seller. Let them get comfortable with it with their attorney. Also, this is the right thing to do. The real reason my attorney and I came up with this was I'm a solo operator for all intents and purposes. I mean, I've got Drew, but if I die, Drew's going to throw himself on my funeral pyre, so he won't be around either. And, you know, the bookkeeper could keep sending, but, you know, who knows what would happen if I dropped dead with my subject twos. I want them to continue to get paid, and if they can't continue to get paid, I want them to get their houses back with all the payments I've made, all the mortgage amortization. I don't care. If I'm gone, And no one running my estate can take care of this. I want them to have their houses back. Now, this is one of those things that I said it would take 20 minutes to really explain it. So if you want to really dig into this, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning in the bookstore. Explain all about it, because some of you are going, what? Because you don't know what a land trust is. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning in the bookstore, we'll talk more about this. We do not do kitchen table closings. You are owners of the higher-end houses that you would really like to own. When you say, let's meet at your house and do this closing, they're just going to be like, oh, what kind of scam is this? Closings happen at title companies or at attorney's offices, right? It doesn't make you look like you're a trustworthy professional, and you will lose deals if you try and close them at the kitchen table. Also, how are you going to get a title search? Do you need a title search? Are you just going to believe the seller when he says, this is my only mortgage? Do you maybe need to get an owner's policy of title insurance? Would you like somebody to call up the bank and confirm that the balance is what you think it is? Like, there's all kinds of great reasons to actually do this with an attorney. I just can't describe to you. The longer you're in real estate, the more you realize that people are just weird, okay? And I have heard two different stories from two different investors who did subject twos and closed at McDonald's, and then later had the seller, like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years later, had the seller move back into the house. And the reason is, the sellers gave, in one case, the guy, the house was vacant. It was between tenants, and he went to show it, and the locks had been changed. He couldn't figure out what was going on, so he called a locksmith and drilled the locks out, and he opened it up. It's full of furniture. And later, the sellers came home from work, and he said, what are you doing? And they said, well, we decided that we didn't like our new house, so we were just going to move back in here. And he said, but you don't own it anymore. And they said, well, sure we do. And he said, well, no. Remember, you signed that deed. They were like, you mean at McDonald's? We just thought that was a lease or something. They conveniently forget what they don't want to remember. But if there's an attorney sitting there, they remember. Also, you need more documentation for this than just a deed. You are tied to this seller financially for years. You are responsible for keeping their credit good for years by making those payments on time and in full, right? Stuff could happen. The seller could die. And now you need to get a mortgage payoff. How's that going to work? There could be an insurance claim. And you need to be able to deal with the insurance company. How's that going to work when it's the seller's name still on the mortgage? You might decide you want to pay off the loan. How are you going to get a loan balance with a dead seller? Or one that you've just lost touch with? Also, the seller might forget that they don't get to write off the taxes. The seller might forget that they don't get to live in the house anymore. The seller might forget that you didn't promise to pay off the loan early. I've had that happen too. Sellers call me and say, I just tried to get a loan, and they said you hadn't paid the loan off, and you said you were going to pay it off within a year. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. I heard you. And my husband heard you too. So, how do we solve these things ahead of time? Number one, yes, we need a deed, but number two, we need to get a signed, notarized, limited, durable power of attorney. It's only for the house. It says, Dina gets to deal with anybody who needs to be dealt with about the house, the bank, the insurance company, the local officials, whatever. We need a signed payoff request that does not have a date in it or a loan number in it or a bank name in it. Because by the time you decide to pay off the loan, that mortgage could have transferred to 3 separate banks and had different account numbers the whole time, right? So we just want them to sign it. It's a payoff request. They sign it, and then we fill it out when we need it. We need a change of address form to be sent to the lender so that we get the mail, so that we don't miss it when the taxes went up and therefore the payment did. And we need a detailed disclosure outlining outlining every single solitary thing that could go wrong with this deal in the future. So, like, what kind of thing would we maybe want to outline?
So, I have a question. The change of address form to be sent to the lender, the change of address for the seller?
Yeah, it says, from now on, lender, send all of the mail for Joe Bob to Vina.
Okay.
So I have 15 pieces of mail a month coming into my office that have somebody else's name on them. But they're coming to my office because they're bank statements from subject to deals. So what kind of thing would we want to put in this disclosure?
If the person passes away.
Okay, yeah, what happens if you die? Yeah, that's a really common question, too. What happens if I die? I keep making your payments.
What happens if you die?
What happens if I die? How about there's a due on sale clause in your mortgage? And what it says is, if the lender finds out and cares, they could call this loan due. And if that happens, here's what we're going to do. Should you disclose that? How about you don't get to write off the interest anymore? How about you're not entitled to any insurance proceeds anymore? How about if... how about I have not promised to pay off this loan at any particular time? How about you have the seller initial every line, and then when they call you and say, you said you'd pay this loan off in 2 or 3 years, you can say, can I get your email address because I want to send you the thing that you signed when we closed. That has saved me from so many problems because they shut up when they see that they did, in fact, hear what I am saying. Now, you do the disclosure a little differently than I do. I put it in writing.
Yes, and I was surprised. I don't do a written disclosure. And I thought maybe I would have one in my documents. And today, Vina and I were looking. I went on my computer, and I do not have a disclosure for a subject to deal. And that really surprised me. And I was like, wow. That kind of got me. But I actually do have one, but we're talking about something else. Anyway, the thing I do, this is true for tenants, or this is true for subject to deals. I put the person on video, and I have them explain to me the deal. So I've done a really good job teaching them to making sure they understand all the ramifications that can happen. And we go through it. I sit there with a question and answer thing, and we go through this, and they have to answer the question. They have to explain the deal to me. And if they can't, what do I do? I go over it again. And I make sure that they, until they can explain to me the way I would explain it to them, then I have not done my job. So I use that disclosure because they get it and they understand it.
And he's got proof that they got it and understood it.
But I really like what Vina's doing, where her disclosure is phenomenal. It's really good. And there's ways you can trip up with 72 deals. And Kim and I did our first 72 deal, I think, in 98. And we didn't really know what we were doing. But you'll get this. You'll understand it. And you'll move forward. And it's just making sure you're honest and you're straight up with everybody. You don't overpromise and underdeliver. We see that all the time. So instead, under-promise and over-deliver.
You also have them sign a CYA.
Yeah, I'm about to say I do have a CYA, but we do the video. I rely heavily on that video.
Okay, let me challenge you. What if you got the seller they really like the idea of just letting somebody else take over their loan and moving on with their life and not having to deal with the house anymore, and then you put this disclosure in front of them and they go, oh my God, I didn't understand any of this. Now I don't want to do it. Is that good or bad? No, that's good. That's good. Because clearly they didn't understand what they were doing before you put the disclosure. And it would have come back up anyway. So have it come up before you close so that, you know, maybe there's some stuff in there that they're just like, well, I don't understand this. And you can explain it, right? Or they have a concern and it's not, you know, you have a quick way of overcoming the concern. All right, next wrong thing, keeping the seller's insurance policy in place. This is the wrong insurance protection. You will not be covered. Now, this requires us to talk a little bit about the due on sale clause. You've been probably waiting for that. The due on sale clause, this is the thing that keeps most real estate investors who don't really understand subject twos from doing subject twos. The due on sale clause says that if the borrower transfers title interest in the property, the bank, with one exception, and that is to heirs on their death, the bank cannot call your loan due because you died and your kids now have the property, or because they transferred it into a living trust, like Lee Phillips was talking about, where the borrower remains the beneficiary. Remember I said that whole thing about I said that whole thing about land trust defeat the due on sale clause is a misreading. What Garn St. Germain Act says is if the seller transfers a property into a trust and then the seller stays the beneficiary of that trust, the bank can't call the loan due. That's not what's happening in a land trust. You become the beneficiary in that land trust. So if the borrower transfers title interest other than in those cases, the bank has the right to call the loan due and payable immediately, even if all the payments are up to date. That's what the due on sale clause says. So they call the loan due. They have to give legal notice. In Ohio, that's going to be a 30-day notice to say you got to make this right or we're foreclosing. And if the loan is not paid off or otherwise the default is cured, or this is a default within the mortgage, if the default is not cured, then the bank can institute foreclosure proceedings. And that ends in an auction, right? The bank doesn't just, like, take the property. It ends in an auction. They try to sell the property to get their loan proceeds back. If that happens to happen, it's kind of bad for everybody. Your seller loses. How? It's a foreclosure on his credit record. It's pretty ugly. You lose. How? They lose the property and all the cash flow and any improvements you put in it. If you have a lease option buyer in that property, he loses. How? He can't buy the property. Also, the bank loses. Do you know it costs banks on average $15,000 to foreclose on a property? And depending on where you live, it takes, well, if you live where Bill lives, like 2 days for the bank to do a foreclosure. But here in Ohio and in all other judicial states, it can be 7, 10, 13 months before they can get the property to auction. So it's very expensive for the bank, which is probably why it never happens. Okay? You understand that most of the time when you're making a payment to a bank, they don't actually have any money in that mortgage. They're servicers. They may have made the loan originally, and then 2 days later they sold it to Fannie Mae, who then securitized it. So Fannie Mae doesn't really own it either. There's a city in Norway that owns a piece of the mortgage package, and there's a fireman's retirement fund that owns a piece of the package, and Joe Bob owns a piece of the package. There's nobody there who's like, damn it, somebody just bought my mortgage, because the mortgage is put in this giant pool, and then the pool is chopped up, and it goes out to bunches and bunches of different people. Most bank payments are automated. People will say, "Well, but I mean, but they don't. When they don't, they notice when they get a check from a different person." Did you just ask if Bank of America notices among the 50,000 mortgages they're servicing that your check came from you instead of Joe Bob? No human being looks at those checks. They run them through a machine that scans the number at the bottom and deposits the money. Nobody calls up the bank when the deed changes hands and says, hey, this is the Hamilton County Courthouse. We just want to let you know that a house that you have a mortgage on, that doesn't happen. Okay, so the chances that they will find out at all are pretty slim. Most institutions that have or service mortgages would rather have a performing one than a non-performing one. And by saying, well, your payments are up to date, but we're foreclosing on you. Didn't they just spend a whole bunch of money for nothing? I would love to be the banker explaining to my investors why I did that. Yeah, this was a really great performing loan, and now it's gone non-performing even though they made the last payment before it went non-performing. What happened? Oh, we foreclosed on it because they dared to change the deed over to somebody else. Mostly, the lenders never notice the transfer, and you just make payments for 20 years, and nobody ever says anything to you at all. Now, there are some things that will absolutely make these lenders sit up and take notice. Number one, get behind on the payments. They will absolutely, they'll go do a title search, they'll have somebody drive by the house, they'll do the whole nine yards if you get behind in the payments. Number two, you are a borrower, call up the bank and say, hey, guess what I did? Number three, if the borrower declares bankruptcy, they'll get a whole big package from the bankruptcy court. They'll start cross-checking the files, see if the payments are up to date. At that point, they might notice. I've had two borrowers declare bankruptcy. I was terrified that that was going to happen to me. It did. The bank said nothing. I kept making payments. Number four, the taxes get behind. Now, most mortgages you take over now, the taxes are part of the escrow. But if it's an old mortgage, if it's like pre-2006, you might have to pay the taxes separately. If you let those get behind, the bank will notice that the deed changed hands. Probably the most common reason that the bank notices that there's been a change of ownership is the insurance lapses or they believe that the insurance has lapsed. They get a policy that they can't match to their loan is why they would believe it lapsed. You paid for the policy, it got there, but they can't line it up with what loan this is for. So what sometimes happens is the bank notices. And you get a call. This happened to me two times in 2019, two different banks. Hello, this is Fred from, I'm not going to say the actual mortgage lender, but you would know, or the servicer, but you would know who it was. We are calling about the property on Parrish Avenue. We noticed that there was a deed transfer about 4 months ago, but we never received payoff. And I said, yes, that's correct. The guy at the end of the phone said, well, when can we expect it? And I said, well, let me see. There's 23 and a half years left on the loan, so sometime between now and 23 and a half years from now. And the guy at the other end of the phone said, you can't do that. And I said, well, as you can see, I did do that. And they said, we're going to have to refer this to legal. And I said, okay, let's talk about what you should say to legal. I am going to make all of these payments up until the day I get a notice from you that you're foreclosing, and then I'm going to stop. And it's going to take you about 13 months to foreclose on me here in Kentucky. This is a property in Kentucky. And during that time, I will not pay the taxes, I will not pay the insurance, and I will not pay the monthly payment because I have put money into this house, and the way I'm going to get it back is I'm going to rent it and not pay you. So y'all get to decide, do you want a performing note, or do you want to do a foreclosure on a uninsured property with no taxes being paid? Now, would I really do that? No, I would not. I would not do that to the seller unless the seller had already declared bankruptcy and his credit couldn't get any worse. Never got another call from either bank. They just went, okay, we'll get back to you, and then they didn't. So you hear stories about people who got a loan acceleration letter, but Bill and I were talking about this, and we have never actually had someone be able to produce those. We think what's happening is people get the phone call, and they panic, and they pay off the loan. Never actually seen a loan acceleration letter. So if you happen to get one of those, what do you do? Well, one thing is you could just talk to the bank, see what they want to do. If it makes sense, you can pay off the loan before the foreclosure. Like, if you've been paying on it for 10 years and the balance is down to $23,000, just pay it off. Who cares? If the market has dropped a lot and the seller is willing, you can say, look, I'll pay you off, but I don't want to pay you what the loan balance is because the property's not worth that anymore. We need to talk about a short sale. Now, the seller will have to cooperate with you on that. You can't just, like, do it all by yourself. If you have a buyer on the property, somebody is a lease option buyer, You can call up and say, listen, I kind of need you to buy this thing right away, and if you can do that, I'll give you a 10% discount on the price we talked about. If the seller has declared bankruptcy, you can stop making the payments because you're not going to make his credit worse. Or you could cure the default. If all else fails, you're the owner, sign the deed back to the seller. The default is cured. You don't like it. Seller might not even like it. They might be like, well, I never want to see this house again. Okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to sign it back to you, and then we're going to do a lease option that duplicates that you will never have to worry about it. I'm going to keep taking care of the tenants and the repairs and the maintenance. We're just going to do this a different way. So back to the insurance. If you leave the seller's policy in place and there is a loss, you will be completely unprotected. You will receive no money. If anyone receives money, it will probably be the seller. Good luck talking them out of that $80,000 check that they got from the insurance company to do the repairs on your house. If you leave the seller's policy in place and also get your own, which seems to be the most common YouTube solution, you will also be completely unprotected. I've talked to multiple insurance agents about this, and they said, here's what's going to happen. Your insurance company is going to try and subordinate to the seller, and the seller's insurance company is going to try and subordinate to, and they will fight it out, and they will both say, we're not paying. It wasn't appropriately insured. The correct answer is, have the seller cancel his policy the day of the closing where you have a brand new policy that names you or your trustee, if that's how you took title, as the primary insured, names the lender as the loss payee, because that's what the lender wants to see is we are insured, and names the seller as something called additional insured as their interests appear. That way, when the bank gets the policy, they see their name on it, check. They see the seller's name on it, check. They see it's the right amount, check, and they don't call you. Got it? That is the only right way to do this. You guys can't take pictures faster than that, seriously? All right, so last, the bonus wrongness. Flip it to another investor for $5,000 and walk away. What's wrong with this? All right, I heard you screwed somebody. Yeah, you made a mess, and now it's somebody else's mess. But that's not the only reason. You agreed to make the payments. And now you have pushed that off to somebody that you don't really know, and they stop making the payments. Who's the seller going to call?
You.
And rightly so. You were the one who made them trust you and said, I'll take care of this, and then you passed it off to somebody else. We're going to have time to go through maybe one of these three things that we wanted to do as bonus material here. There's some stuff that we haven't been able to talk about that you will run across in real life. For instance, what if you find a deal that looks really, really good on the surface? All right, so this one is a $75,000 two-family, needs $30,000 in work, $1,150 a month rent when you're done with it. And the seller will sell it for $18,500. You like it? For 75 needs 30 in work, seller will sell it for 18.5. You like it?
Yeah.
Subject to is 4.875% loan. You like it better?
Yeah.
That has payments of $190 a month. You like it better? And only has 11 years left. You like it better?
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds like a grand slam, doesn't it? What if you don't like two families and you don't want to own properties in this area? Sign the subject to. There you go. No. So here is what I did in this exact situation. I actually did this house. Is Adam here? I know he's here at the conference. He's not here in the room. The buyer is here at the conference. You can stay in the middle. You can overcome the ethical problem with flipping a subject to contract by selling this deal to somebody that you know is, like, very experienced, very ethical, knows what they're doing with rental properties, knows what they're doing with rehab, by wrapping the financing. So what I did was I sold it for $29.9. Adam put $9,900 down, and then he paid the rest to me at 10% interest for 12 years with payments of $239 a month. So it's kind of like a wholesale deal, right? Got cash up front, got a payment coming in every month that was bigger than the payment going out every month, but it wasn't my house because I sold it to him on a contract for deed. It was his house. Now, the thing is, day one, I had to pay $800 to close this deal because the guy wasn't, like, giving me the property subject to his loan and also paying the closing costs. But $9,900 came back in that same day. I went from the closing company over to my office. He paid the $9,900 down payment. In months 2 through 132, $239 came in and $190 went out. And then in months 133 through 144, $239 came in and nothing went out. What happened? Underlying loan was only 11 years left. So why is this better than flipping the contract? You stay in control, right? The buyer doesn't make a payment. What do? You still make the payment, and you deal with the buyer. You don't make it some civilian seller's job to deal with the buyer. This one we're going to have to skip. But there's another similar example right after, and the and this is an example. Sometimes you find subject twos where you really like the loan, but the loan is so small compared to the value of the house that you have to come up with cash to do the deal. Can you imagine a situation like that? Or maybe house needs work. You got to come up with cash for that.
So this is Kennesaw, Due West Road. Again, these are in Georgia. And on this particular property, the way I was, guess how I found it? Door knocking. Y'all see kind of a trend here? So, again, Matthew 7:7, just remember that. So I found it through door knocking, and in this case it had another realtor sign in the front yard. People always ask, well, I'll knock on that door, and the answer is yes. And in this case, I knocked on the door, the seller invited me in, which is usually the case. I ask a lot of questions when I'm in the seller's house. And one of the main things I found out about this is her husband had been transferred to Phoenix. And he was already there. So now she has her kids and the dog, actually two dogs. And she didn't like having the house on the market because every time the house was going to be shown, she got a call from the realtor who said, get the dogs out, get the kids out. So she would clean up the house really fast. And this is another little secret for you guys. So where did she go?
McDonald's.
She had her car and she left. She had to leave, but where'd she go? McDonald's. One of the things I do when I take a big group out door knocking at lunchtime, I'll go into the play area, because there's always about three or four women in there and kids, and I'll sit back and say, I'm sorry, I didn't get the name, but I was supposed to meet a lady. They have their house on the market for sale, and I heard she might be here. And two of the three women will raise their hand, oh, that's me. I know, it's not worth the price of admission. Okay, so this is the mortgage. And I said it originated in 2009. I think it originated in 2007. I'm not sure. I had that date wrong. But the property's fair market value is 160, but the mortgage balance is 61,000. Is there a lot of equity here? Yeah. Tons of equity. And look at the interest rate. You have rent 1,100, so there's a lot of cash flow here. This is a home run, right? But you go over here and you realize that the seller needs to receive $75,000 at closing. She was like, I don't mind subject to, I don't mind you making my mortgage payments for me, but I need to have the difference because where we're going to go to in Phoenix, I need to use that money there. And I only had one small problem. What was the problem?
$75,000.
Other than not having any of the money, we're good to go. So then I turned to a private money lender, and I brought in a private money lender who's going to give me loan me the money. It'll be secured to this property in second position. But look how this loan was written. So it's a 30-year interest only. So when you get interest only, what happens to payments? they go down. So they were getting a lower interest rate, and they were happy with getting the 188. But the way I made up for it was when we sell the house one day, so you know what, at some point in time when we sell it, they'll get their $75,000 back plus 25% of the upside, which can be significant. So that's how this deal was funded. So even though you don't have the money, that's why it's so important to be a member of UREA and to build a network and friends, because there's always people around you who can help you with what you don't have or what you don't know. They can help and bring that to the table if you'll give up part of the deal.
Would you believe that not every private lender wants 14% interest and 4 points? Some of them actually want growth and upside.
So this was a private money lender, not hard money. Why do they call it hard money? It's hard to pay back. This is a private money lender where their money is in the bank earning 0.0001% interest. And we can pay a lot more than that. But here's where this house stands today. It's now worth $275,000. And the cash flow is $930 a month. Was this a good deal? So just understand, you can't walk, but what if I hadn't got out of my car and knocked on the door and cared enough to ask her about her problems? You have to take that step. Remember Matthew 7:7. Knock and...
So subject twos can be stacked with other creative deal structures. In the example I skipped, I had a similar problem. I had an owner who had a house that she wanted 160 for, worth 275, but her loan was only 97,000, and she wanted the difference in cash. She didn't want to sell it for 97,000, and the deal we made was I paid her the difference at $500 a month until paid. Seller held second mortgage at what percent interest?
Zero.
So you can use subject twos along with other kinds of creative deals to put together stuff that otherwise doesn't make sense. Because subject two, you get it, it's only one tool in the creative deal toolbox, right? What are you going to do when you find a deal where there's no loan to take over? Subject twos don't work when there's no mortgage. And yet sometimes those sellers are willing to take payments. What's that called? A seller held financing. What do you do if the property needs $6,000 in rehab to put it into service and you don't have the money? Get a partner. Get a private lender. What do you do if the seller hates the property, like does not want it anymore? This is typically a rental housing provider. But they will not sell because the idea of paying the capital gains tax on a property they've owned for 30 years, some of you have dealt with this seller, I can tell you're nodding. The idea of paying the capital gains tax just makes them want to throw up. How do you get control of that property? Lease option! They haven't sold it. There's no capital gains tax, and yet here you are, can complete control of that property. What do you do when the seller actually does want the property, but can't keep it because they need, let's say, a heater and central air unit? They use an option. What do you do with sellers who have really great deals that you really like, but they really do need cash for them?
Partner
or private lender. See, there's all sorts of options out there that aren't subject to. There's seller carryback notes, there's lease options, there's private lenders, there's partners, and there's those long-term options. So which one of these should you learn? All of them. Knowing all of them is the best strategy. It's like you go to the seller and you talk to them and they tell you what the problem is. You're like a mechanic diagnosing a car. And if you diagnose that the problem is the alternator and what you have sitting next to you is a transmission, you can't solve the problem. The more tools you have, the more problems you can solve. So, how do you get all the tools? Well, Bill and I would like to personally invite you to come to Florida in February.
Again. You can clap.
We don't have to have a class, do we? Let's just all go to Florida in February. February 4th, 5th, and 6th in Tampa. If for some reason there is something the matter with your brain and you're like, no, I don't want to go to Florida in February, you can also attend this via simulcast. We'll have a camera in the back of the room. We will be simulcasting the entire class. When you come to the Ultimate Creative Deal Structuring Workshop, you are going to learn how to find and negotiate and document all of those kinds of deals. Subject twos, owner-held seller-held mortgages, my favorite kind being 0% interest, seller-held mortgages, leases with option to buy, deals with partners, and deals with private financing that are way more creative than what you're just used to negotiating an interest rate and making that payment. We talk about stuff that's way more creative than that, giving lenders a piece of the upside instead of giving them 8% interest. When you attend this, you get every form and contract that you need to document these deals, and that includes some of the ones we talked about today, the Seller Protection Land Trust, the Subject to Disclosure, the Durable Power of Attorney, and a couple of dozen others, because that's just one strategy's worth of documents right there. You also get recordings of the entire event. The typical reaction of somebody who's newish to the real estate business when they come to this is they walk out going, you know what I learned? I learned how to do lease options. And we're like, good, but we taught a bunch of other things. Yeah, but what I learned was how to do lease options. The rest of it was just too much. That's why you want the recordings, to listen to it over and over and over and over again, because every time you listen to it, you'll be like, that's not the same recording. I swear to God, I heard different stuff this time. Also, because creative deal structuring is creative, we have created weekly follow-up meetings where you can bring deals and say, help me figure out how to do this. Help me figure out the best structure to do this. But all those things are not why you should come. Those are just features. Those are just stuff you get. The reason you should come is because you need to build your skills so that you can do more deals out of the deals you're already seeing. You can double up the number of deals you're doing right now without spending an extra dime on marketing, and these are deals that create your long-term financial freedom, right? These are deals that you can own them. You can own them for years and years and years. You haven't qualified for them. You haven't put down big down payments. You're going to learn more strategies for solving seller problems, and in that room full of people, you're going to meet a bunch of really creative financial friends and allies who will do deals with you. You think I'm kidding, but on this Wednesday night call, we have now seen a bunch of deals where somebody came in and said, the problem is I don't have the $65,000 to do the repairs, and someone else has said, I do, because they're creative, and they work out a deal between themselves, and it's a win-win deal. You can sign up for this thing anytime. It's up on Bill's website, I mean, until we run out of seats, I guess, you can sign up to it. It's $12.97 to attend live. It is $15.97 to attend by simulcast. If you want to know why the difference, ask Drew, who's getting paid to run the simulcast equipment. Drew is easy, but he is not cheap. You can bring a spouse or a partner, so somebody you're actually doing business with is what we mean here, for an additional $300, and it includes a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Now, you know OREA has a guarantee that says you can return anything in 30 days and get your money back. We have a guarantee over and above that. Come to all 3 days, and if you don't walk out going, oh, my God, I'm going to make so much more money now than I did before. I mean, I see deals that I could have done before that didn't, but I can do now. You tell us at the end of the 3 days, and we'll write you a check back for your entire tuition. Is that fair? Does the word fair mean different, something different here in Warren County than it does in Hamilton County? I just said, if you're not completely satisfied, you get your money back. All right, now let me tell you why you should sign up today. You can do it anytime you want, but here's why you should do it today. We agreed to do an OREA special at $897 for one person and $200 for the partner or spouse. That is a big, big discount over what other folks are going to be paying for this. And in addition, we're going to throw in something that the people who sign up from here on out don't get. Last year's manual, This is it. This is not what you're going to carry home because it'll overwhelm the weight limit for those of you who are flying.
And I'm going to have this in the bookstore all day tomorrow. So every time you see me in there, I'm going to have this. You're welcome to flip through it and see what's in here.
And the recordings of last year's workshop. Now, why would we do this? Why do we want you to review last year before you go to this entirely new one this year? You'll come prepared. You'll have better questions. You'll have a higher level of understanding. And we are going to insert you into those Wednesday night support classes as soon as you can honestly say, I went through that manual and I understand what these guys are talking about. Okay? So you can start that now. You don't have to wait until February.
And is Anita here? Anita, can you stand up? Where's Kevin? Is Kevin in here? We have people who help us with this thing, and they're there every week. They've done a great job. We've been doing this for 2 years.
Yep.
Every Wednesday night.
Also, if you get it today, of course, you get to have the extra special feeling that, hey, my money's going to Aria, who does great things for me as a real estate investor year-round, not just during 4 days during the convention. So, you also need to be one of the first 25 people who do this, because God knows I love Aria. I provably love Aria. The amount of time I spend every year on Aria, I love them, but I don't love them enough to give away all of our seats at this price. Okay, so we have reserved 25 seats for Aria attendees to come to this. If you're one of the first 25, you get all these bonuses. The $400 off last year's manual and recordings, which, I mean, you could go on Bill's website and buy that, but it's $9.97. And immediate access to the Wednesday night support calls, which I'm telling you guys, that is priceless. Having a group of creative people around you who can talk you through deals that you're just like, I don't even understand how to get my brain around that. Unbelievable support. So you do that now by going to the back of the room. Going to the back of the room is how you do that right now. Going to the back of the room. That's the back of the room back there. Or there is a web link where you can just sit in your chair. You don't even have to get up and go to the back of the room. I had intended to put that web link up on that slide, but apparently I spaced out. I wonder what else could be on my mind. It is oreaconvention.com/.
Why is this in the back?
This was ill thought out. It is oreaconvention.com/CrookCox.
What?
They could have made it Bill and Vina, but it's Cook Cox. C-O-K-C-O-X. C-O-X. Don't misspell it. It's C-O-X. I'm going to have to suck.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's so innocent.
That is wrong on so many levels.
All right. So, I actually have to go run to the dinner over at that Roger Valdez is going to be at, but you're going to stand in the back and answer questions for people. I will see y'all in the bookstore at 8 a.m. to talk about the land trust. Bill will see you there at 10 a.m.
And I'll be in there a lot more than that, so I'll be in there a lot.